You're not.
I guess she would qualify as furniture.
Oh, you're a charitable man, John Fox. You're a charitable man. We've done it to another hour, though, brother. I'm looking forward to great Thursday edition, well, at least here, of All Foxed Up on the Other Side, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Billy Shears Music Night.
Coming up.
Yep.
All right.
And we'll see you on the other side, mate.
All right, brother. Stand by. And so, here's the late, great Lowell George, reminding you to...
This is a top to what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11,
oh,
11,
and most
11,
and amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show, right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Thursday night or Friday morning or Friday afternoon, all depending on where you are on this beautiful blue marble, such that it still is. It's a couple of minutes after whatever hour it is where you are. And being that it's Thursday, that means it's Billy Shears Music Night, and in just a little bit we'll have part 5 of Lennon on Lennon, Blame It on Bermuda. And I think last week I actually called it Blame It on Rio. What a knob am I? But anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. Got a few things that we're going to talk about today, and one of them is actually an interesting little piece that Gene sent me earlier about it's either Gene or Betsy. I have to say I'm not sure which. About the carbon emissions from the Olympic torch. And I'll get into that in a little bit. But for those of you that have, that listen to the show regularly, you know that, that Billy's been running this great series here on Foxed Up on Lennon. And it's been some fantastic stuff with, you know, in-studio footage and whatnot. And like I said, you know, I know if he ever told me where he gets these bits of audio, he'd have to kill me. But I'd rather that not happen and, you know, keep bringing these bits to you. and just to warn you all, sometime during the program, I may have to step away, because I do have some gardening stuff on being delivered, at any moment. So I've actually given Mr. Bob Kincaid a few extra little bits of music to fill, possibly, if I have to run out and tell them, well, where to dump it all and to pay for it. Because it's time to plant the winter veggies. The seedlings are all kind of going and rocking. In fact, we're a little bit late. You know, doing that kind of thing. And, yeah, I can't wait to see that. And the fact that the tomatoes are still going crazy, I can't get over it. And we've had that, and this has been the funniest thing, and I've been talking to Nanette about this throughout the season. Our zucchini plants went runaway to the point where they ran out of the raised bed that we built. And, oh, I'd say like a good 3-4 yards into the lawn. But then something really funny happened. We thought that it had kind of killed itself by the huge stalk that came over the wall of the bed was drying out, but no. It dried out, and it re-rooted itself into the yard. It's like the plant that won't die. And it's still popping out zucchini. It's pretty cool. You got to love nature. Anyway, folks, it's Billy Shear's music time, and so we're going to go straight to that. And so this is part 5 of Lennon on Lennon. Blame It on Bermuda. I reckon this will be just as fascinating as all the previous bits. And don't forget Billy Shear's Saturday night, 9 to midnight Eastern time, here on the Head On Radio Network with Night Sounds. You can check them out at billyshearsmusic.com. So without further ado, Lennon on Lennon. Roll it, Bob.
This is the Head On Radio Network. The Horn.
This is part 5 and the final installment of my series, Lennon on Lennon, Blame It on Bermuda. So let's continue our journey with John in Bermuda.
Take one. Darling boy, now known as beautiful boys.
This is one of John's demo tapes, a very special song that he wrote about his 5-year-old son, Sean, who was on vacation with his dad at the time. John does the song several ways and then plays the tapes for the other musicians in the studio when they get together to record in New York.
That's the Bermuda tape. You were on it. Because there's only one rhythm place where this works. I don't know what. It's the right rhythm. The only way this sounds right. You know.
That time.
That rhythm. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Well, am I staying in this room or what? You know your parts, don't you? You did it in the room with us.
Yeah.
Why are you sitting down with no headphones and no guitar?
I was just remembering it. Check it out.
Come on, let's do it. We can do it in one take, this thing.
The tender emotional side of John. Another personal track on the album, Woman, was written for Yoko, but as John pointed out at the time, the meaning goes much deeper.
I like that one, although I'm sort of embarrassed because it sort of sounds a bit like Girl and a bit Beatly and a bit, but I do like it.
Why does that embarrass you?
Because I'm still a bit feeling I'm supposed to be macho Butch Cassidy or something and tough Lennon with a leather jacket and swearing and all that, and I really am just as romantic as the next guy, you know, I always was. It's the sort of 80s version of Girl to me, you know. Like I referred to the other ones, Elvis Orbison, and this one I call the Beatle track all the time. I said, oh, the Beatle track, let's do the Beatle track tonight. But to me, it suddenly dawned on me about the woman thing. I was in Bermuda again, and it suddenly sort of hit me about what women represent to us, not as the sex object or the mother, but just their contribution. That's why you hear me muttering at the beginning for the other half of the sky, which is Chairman Mao's famous statement, that it is the other half. I mean, all this thing about man, woman, is a joke. Without each other, there ain't nothing. Mm-hmm. So it was like this sort of, my God, it was a different viewpoint of what I'd felt about women, and I can't express it better than I said in the song. Mm-hmm. And it's for Yoko, but it's to all women.
Well, that's it for this special series, Lennon on Lennon, Blame It on Bermuda. My hope is that it brings a new understanding of the creative genius and an appreciation of John Lennon's last body of work he left behind, Double Fantasy. And what a masterpiece it is. Thank you, John. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Thank you, Billy. What are you thanking me for, man? It's been an incredible series. And, you know, I find it really interesting to hear that, you know, even that late in his career, you know, he was still fighting with the image that he thought other people had of him. You know, the fighting, cussing, leather jacket wearing tough guy. And, you know, that was still an internal battle with him in the creative process at the time of making something like Double Fantasy. You know, a genius, again, you know, I just sometimes sit and think, you know, what would it be like today if, you know, John was still around? And, you know, I know that he'd be on a no-fly list. He'd be on the streets shouting to the rooftops how illegal the war is, and still fighting for people's human rights and civil rights, and fighting for the poor, and, you know, the loss of John Lennon wasn't just a musical one. It was one of the greater human spirit, and, you know, it's something that I just really think is so badly missed today. We really could use John today. I really just think the world would be a different place. And, you know, not to overstate what one person can do, but hey, you know, he brought attention to things during Vietnam in ways that other people couldn't. He always spoke very, very clearly in his music about certain issues, and you know, I continue to miss him. So thanks, Billy. It was an amazing series, fantastic. You know, I've always reckoned that Woman was one of the most interesting tracks he ever did. Both those tracks and Beautiful Boy, you know, those are really, for an artist, leaving oneself vulnerable when you take on the fact that, you know, there's an assumed image of, you know, this tough guy. And he was, you know, yeah, he was a tough guy, you know. You couldn't knock him down. He didn't shy away. But his toughness came from having a huge heart and a great spirit, and, you know, it's something that I still miss today. So, again, thanks, Billy, and don't forget Shears Music, Saturday night, 9 to midnight Eastern Time. Check him out at billyshearsmusic.com. So, the Gardening Guys haven't showed up yet, but that could happen at any moment. And I've been talking a lot about the Olympic torch relay, and it's all been in regards to the politicizing of the Olympics and the whole Tibet-China mess. But, you know, here's something that I hadn't even considered. I mean, I considered it, but, you know, here you go. Someone's actually done the math. From Wired, Olympic torch emits 5,500 tons of CO2. That's right, 5,500 tons. Let's say here, angry protesters, riot police, mass demonstrations, arrests for disorderly conduct. It hasn't exactly been smooth sailing for the Olympic torch relay. People are looking for another reason to be pissed at China. How about this? By the time the pyro parade is over, it will have produced over 11 million pounds of carbon emissions. The torch is visiting 23 cities during a global sweep that includes stops in London, Paris, San Francisco, Bangkok, Islamabad, and Almaty, among others. The Beijing Olympic Organization Committee says the journey will cover more than 85,000 miles. So when the torch isn't being marched through city streets or extinguished by protesters, threatened by fire extinguisher or armed protesters, how's it getting around? You guessed it, by plane. An Air China A330 custom painted with the Olympic logo and color scheme. The A330 burns four to five gallons of fuel per mile. Sorry, it's a bit of a badly written typo there. That translates to 462,400 gallons for the entire trip. With Earth Lab estimating that every gallon of jet fuel burned produces 23.88 pounds of CO2, the Olympic torch relay is adding about 11 million pounds of carbon to the atmosphere. That's 5,500 tons. We did some digging around to put that number in perspective. Here's what we came up with. A round-trip flight between New York and Los Angeles produces 2.4 tons of CO2. Driving 12,000 miles in a 2006 Ford Explorer, 7.83 tons. The British Virgin Islands emit 84,000 tons of CO2 per year. The European Union, 3.1 billion, and the United States, 6 billion. A 250-guest wedding, assuming that 125 attendees spend the night at a high-end hotel, will produce 9 tons of CO2. London has a plan to ensure that the 2012 torch relay ends up carbon neutral, so we figured that Beijing must have one too, right? Sadly, Sally Liu, the frazzled Olympic media relations rep that we reached in Beijing, says that if there is a plan to neutralize the torch-carrying jet's carbon emissions, she hasn't heard about it. But she thinks there is one, probably. Actually, she's not really sure. I would probably guess that at the moment, there isn't. So, you know, if you're looking at just, you know, I find the whole thing a useless exercise to begin with, you know. But here in this age of really having to worry about what we do to the planet, you know, for a marketing exercise, which is all it is, it's a marketing and hype exercise, you know, is this really worth the cost? I would say no. You know, this equates to, you know, here in Sydney, there are trucks that are nothing but rolling billboards that drive around the city, helping to congest traffic even more, to advertise crap you don't need. And when I see these things, you know, I just want to scream. You know, it's bad enough we have advertising everywhere we look. You know, but to actually put vehicles on the road that aren't actually carrying any cargo, and they just have triangular boxes on them with billboards on all three sides, just driving around town, advertising, you know, mobile phones, underwear, McDonald's, or something else. It just does my head in, and I get the impression that a few other people have complained as well, because now I'm seeing them are slowly being replaced by small trailer versions hooked up to like Vespas. But I still think it's just a completely useless waste of resources. It's selfish in so many ways that I can't get my head around how anyone can say, you know, this is going to be a good idea. You know, for me, I see this kind of stuff and it automatically would make me say, even if I was interested in such a product, I would now not buy it because of that. You know, there are better ways to advertise. But hey, you know, that's the consumer world for you. Sell, sell, sell at any cost and no responsibility. But these things are starting to change, I think. A little bit more on the Financial Times has quite a bit of this. Gene also sent this to me. The Financial Times is doing has a section on the Beijing Olympics. And here we go. The Chinese, oh, Yeah, here we go. You know, we're not supposed to boycott the Chinese games, right? They're, you know, all these Olympic organizations and all are saying, oh, it's unfair. It's unfair. Your misguided morality are being unfair to the competitors and unfair to the Chinese who are trying to spin themselves as being such good people. Well, it's not exactly the same story on the other foot. And the page will load sometime here. Via the Financial Times, Chinese are now being urged to boycott French goods. Very interesting. Don't boycott our games. But those damn French, they actually spoke up. They told some truth. Are we gonna see, like we saw in the lead up to the war, you know, where those conservatives set up those fake, those absolute nonsense little protests where they're pouring all the French wine down the gutter? Could be. Will this page ever load? Let's try it again. Talk amongst yourselves. Oh, here we go. Chinese consumers have been urged to boycott French goods in response to the raucous protests that accompanied the Olympic torch through Paris. The appeal circulated on internet chat rooms and bulletin boards indicates the protests earlier this week have not only embarrassed the Beijing government, but also ignited a strong nationalist reaction amongst sections of the Chinese public. Signs of fresh disagreement emerged on Thursday between the government and the International Olympic Committee over the human rights situation in China. Jacques Rogge, IOC president, said that when China was awarded the 2008 Games, government officials promised it would advance the social agenda in China, including human rights. He said, "We definitely ask China to respect this moral engagement." The protests have accompanied the torch relay presented a crisis for the Olympic movement, said Mr. Rogge, who has gone out of his way not to antagonize the host nation. The Chinese government said the IOC should defend the commitment in the Olympics charter to avoid politics and bringing in any irrelevant political factors. Oh, irrelevant is it? When part of the deal that you got the games was you actually had to do something about this issue, so it's not it's now irrelevant? During a visit to Japan, the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan spiritual leader, struck a conciliatory note. He said the Chinese people deserve the Olympics, despite unfortunate events in Tibet. But he welcomed support of the Tibetan cause seen in this week's protests. It is their right to criticize. I have no right to say shut up, he said. He supported only nonviolent protests, however. Absolutely right on. The appeal to boycott French goods appeared on the internet on Wednesday and has spread widely among young Chinese. The webpage bearing a petition appeared to have been blocked on Thursday afternoon. Companies named in the campaign include luxury brands owned by LVMH, such as Louis Vuitton and Givenchy, and the cosmetics group L'Oreal, which have a large business in China. You know, as people's standard of living, or some of them, increases, they like these goods. The torch relay in London was badly disrupted, and the route of the San Francisco leg was changed at the last minute to avoid protests. But it is the events in Paris that appear to have angered the Chinese the most. Very, 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 very interesting. I find that funny. You know, don't protest us, but we're going to protest you. Sound a little out of balance to you? Does to me. Now, they're also saying here, and I know this isn't all very green stuff, but, you know, I'm sorry, human rights are a massive issue to me. To which, actually, living in a survivable planet is a human right, as far as I'm concerned. But it says here, British PM, this is all from the Financial Times, FT.com. British PM to miss Olympic opening. You know, they're all doing their little bit. They're all doing their little bit to quietly embarrass them. Gordon Brown will not attend the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics. Downing Street confirmed on Wednesday night it is a move that could add pressure on other world leaders, including President George W. Bush, to stay away. However, Mr. Brown will attend the closing ceremony of the Games when the Olympic baton will be formally passed to London host city in 2012. You can kind of see it being a little difficult to get out of that one. Downing Street denied any change of policy, arguing that it had made clear on March 19th that the Prime Minister would only attend the closing ceremony. Tessa Joel, Olympics Minister, will represent Britain at the opening ceremony. But the Prime Minister has allowed confusion to develop over his intentions, and the confirmation that he would not be in Beijing for the opening of the Games caused some surprise. Nick Clegg, Liberal Democrat leader, told Channel 4 News that Mr. Brown seems to do the right thing late in the day when he is forced to do so by public opinion. He claimed the move was a last-minute U-turn. Calls for a boycott by Mr. Brown have been gathering since Beijing cracked down on protests in Tibet and intensified this week when the Olympic torch was paraded through London accompanied by Chinese paramilitary police. And I'm glad that this is being covered, the fact that the little guys in the blue shirts are Chinese paramilitary. The same paramilitary that has been beating up on the Tibetans during the most recent uprising. The same guys. They say here, Mr. Brown was unclear on his intentions on April 1st when Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, visited London, insisting that the Dalai Lama, Tibet's spiritual leader, was not calling for a boycott of the Games. He talked of Britain being represented at ceremonies at the Olympics. We will not be boycotting the Olympic Games. Britain will be attending the Olympic Games ceremonies. Downing Street said it was complete rubbish to suggest that there had been a U-turn. Oh, yeah, you know, you can never actually, you know, if you make a U-turn for the right reasons, I think it's okay to admit to it. That means that you're listening. I think people would respect that. You know, if your elected representative, especially if you don't care for what he's doing generally, which seems to be the opinion of many British, as far as I can tell, if you actually make a U-turn in the right direction, wear it proudly. Wear it proudly. It could do. It could probably do a lot for your PR. But anyway, another one that Gene sent me, and this is the kind of stuff that bugs me a bit. It's a piece saying peak oil, petrodollars, and climate change apathy, and this is probably the biggest fight that we have. More than the deniers that are out there, which are a small amount of folks, and boy, have they jumped on this La Nina year! Oh my God, the things that I've been reading, you know, from the deniers coming out, going, "Hey, it got cooler this year. It got cooler this year." See, they're all lying to us. It's all just a lefty stunt. Hello, there are cycles. There are anomalies with anything. You have to look over the long term. Oh yeah, sorry, you people are too shallow to look at the long term. I'm not. Craig McIntosh writes this piece here saying, peak oil and a developing trend to switch international oil trading from the weakening U.S. dollar and the euro may fuel more oil grabs, economic collapse, and further disregard for climate change. World governments, many of whom currently pay lip service to the present and future problems associated with a warming planet, are eager to add to these worries by arguing, and perhaps soon fighting, over anticipated new oil discoveries as the Arctic ice continues to shrink. We know burning fossil fuels causes global warming, but we are tripping over ourselves to find more to burn. This makes it expedient to review some factors involved in our continued free-for-all over oil. Some of what follows may surprise. It is now generally accepted that the invasion of Iraq was prompted not by legitimate concerns about weapons of mass destruction, but over a desire to take control over Iraq's oil reserves. There was never much doubt about this outside of the United States. Iraq holds the second largest proven reserves in the world, next to Saudi Arabia. What is not commonly known, however, is that the that prior to the Iraq invasion, Saddam Hussein had already used an economic form of WMD on the U.S., and one that has set precedent for the superpower could ill afford to ignore. Hussein's action is regarded by some as a primary reason for the Iraqi invasion. More than 2 years prior to the U.S. engagement in Iraq, a nation struggling with more than a decade of trade sanctions after its occupation of Kuwait, this occupation also largely centered around oil, Saddam Hussein made what, at the time, looked like economic suicide by switching from trading oil in dollars to using the euro instead. I talked about this huge a couple of years ago. At the time, there was no financial gain to be had from the move. In fact, quite the opposite. The euro was at a low ebb. It was purely an act of economic aggression, and one of the only remaining weapons the beleaguered nation could wield against the mighty U.S. of A. From November 2000, Iraq is going ahead with its plans to stop using the U.S. dollar in the oil business in spite of warnings the move makes no financial sense. Baghdad this week insisted on and receiving U.N. approval to sell oil through the Oil for Food program in euros only after 6 November. Iraq had threatened to suspend all oil exports, about 5% of the world's total, if the body turned down the request. The move comes despite repeated cautions that Baghdad's departure from the oil industry standard of the dollar will cost the country millions in currency conversion fees. UN officials have said Iraq will have to reduce the price of its crude oil by about 10 cents a barrel in order to compensate buyers for the additional costs. Now, this was from 2000. I've talked about this before. At the same time, Russia was talking about doing the same thing. And if Iraq, Russia, and say, China, decided to start doing oil trade using the euro as the oil currency, the daily cash float that has helped keep the United States economy afloat, because all oil is traded in U.S. dollars, would have vaporized. The fact that all oil is still traded in U.S. dollars creates, you know, an additional daily cash float that the U.S. gets to feed off of. And that little excerpt was from Radio Free Europe. Iraq's threat to stop exporting oil had to be taken seriously. The U.N. approved Hussein's desire to move away from the dollar, which he regarded as the currency of an enemy state. Why would Hussein further weaken his embattled nation by taking such a hit on oil sales? The dollar-euro exchange was considerably less favorable than it is today. In fact, it was predicted Hussein's decision would cost his country around $270 million. Why a switch from the petrodollar to the petro-euro is dangerous to the U.S.? I bet they're going to say a lot of the things here that I was just saying. In the early 1970s, a time when the U.S. overspending on the Vietnam War had significantly depleted U.S. gold reserves, President Nixon removed the gold guarantee on the dollar, effectively making the dollar's value dependent on demand in the global economy. After this time, money was essentially produced at the cost of just paper and ink. Some now refer to it as faith-based currency. But strong demand for the dollar, particularly for oil transactions, made this a workable situation, at least for a time. Let me explain. After a U.S. domestic oil production peaked in the late 1960s, the nation became increasingly dependent on oil imports. But rather than purchasing oil in a foreign currency, the U.S. negotiated with Saudi Arabia so that all oil transaction would be in U.S. dollars. In return, Saudi Arabia was to be assured supplies of arms and assistance to help keep the kingdom's rulers in power. The Saudis agreed, and from this time on, oil transactions worldwide were almost completely made with the greenback. The petrodollar was born. Whether Saudi Arabia was selling to the U.S. or Venezuela was selling to Korea, etc., if you bought and sold oil, it was in U.S. currency. For the U.S., over the last 40 years, this has been an absolute boon. and one that has helped create the energy consumption intensive U.S. lifestyle we witness today. Okay, this explains a lot of why we have so much trouble making headway with an oil-barren government like we have in the United States of actually getting onto alternative fuels, because it ends up interfering in this very market that makes the U.S. dollar even worth anything. And it's starting to bite us on the ass in a big way. Back to the article. It effectively created a free shopping situation for U.S. consumers, like handing the nation a credit card with no limit. Here's how it works. Country A wants to buy oil, but to do so it needs U.S. dollars. So Country A sells products or services to the U.S., getting paper dollars in return. Country A then proceeds to purchase oil from Country B. Dollars are thus required in vast sums by most of the world's governments, and much of that money is never actually cycled back to the U.S. in the form of a purchase, i.e., the international need to keep stocks of U.S. currency ensures that the U.S. often doesn't have to actually provide goods and services in exchange for the paper money it is printing. This also means that the U.S. runs up an economic national debt. But that's okay, so long as those debts are never called in, we're okay. So, you know, when China decides, you know, the credit line's closed, we're screwed. So Mr. McIntosh moves on to heading for disaster. But the writing is on the wall. Those debts may soon begin to get called in, and if this occurs en masse, the real value of the dollar will become evident, with significant adverse economic impacts for the U.S. and beyond. Essentially, if all oil trading were to happen with a currency other than the dollar, the United States' long-term credit with the world would begin to get called in. The results could make the current recession look like a walk in the park, and the world would witness a major shift in economic and thus military power. Several nations are shifting away from the petrol dollar. As it turned out, Saddam Hussein's shift to the euro didn't bring the financial losses expected, as after the defiant switch, the euro rose in value against the dollar. Hussein made a killing. Meanwhile, Iran and other nations took note. Not long after September 11 hit the U.S., psyche like a ton of bricks, and after the subsequent failure to quickly smoke bin Laden out of Afghanistan, George Bush insisted rather promptly, Bush instead turned his attention to other priorities, to what the Bush administration seemed to have regarded as a bigger threat, Operation Iraqi Freedom. It was marked as a bid to protect the American people and to bring freedom and prosperity to Iraqis. It has arguably done neither, and that's quite possibly because those objectives were never the real intent. Instead, Operation Iraqi Freedom made its first priority to take control of and privatize Iraqi oil fields, amongst other things, putting them under the control of the U.S. and UK companies. And wait for it, they promptly put all trading of oil back into U.S. currency, despite the economic losses that incurred as a result of the now reduced value of the dollar. The action essentially said to other oil trading nations, you are either with us or against us. Oil trading is to stay in the U.S. dollar or else. Talk about holding the entire world hostage. Not a nation to be easily intimidated. Neighboring Iran also determined to move away from the petrodollar, adding itself to the list of Axis of Evil nations. By December 2007, Iran had completely switched to trading in other currencies, mostly euros, with some in yen. The Bush administration's apparent impatient circling of Iran and questioning their nuclear program almost perfectly mirrors the kind of media fostered psychological lead-up to the Iraq invasion. Some have, in the past, felt that war with Iran is inevitable, but with the current U.S. and international opinion on a very messy, expensive, unjustified, and illegal war in Iraq turning very sour indeed, combined with a serious U.S. economy downturn, this seems unlikely. Tensions are also rising with the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. like Venezuela, that are moving in the same direction. And it doesn't stop there. Russia was considering moving to the petro-euro, but now seems to prefer not to prop up either the U.S. or European economies. It is looking to switch to its own ascending ruble instead. Starting to see the picture getting painted here, folks? You're starting to see what this whole mess has actually been about? You know, all these people saying no blood for oil and being called nutters, they're not crazy. This whole thing, we covered, Gail covered this beautifully, years ago, before we even went into Iraq on 12th Harmonic Blog. I'll have to go find the links and repost them. It's all about the oil reserve currency. It's all about the oil reserve currency, bottom line. So all this talk about Iran is a threat, Iran is funding al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is a freaking joke. Less than 2% of what we're dealing with in Iraq is al-Qaeda, and there wasn't al-Qaeda in Iraq before we created this absolute mess. You cannot argue with this. Transition for many of these nations is key, going back to this article here. This is at Celsius.com. As they all have large dollar holdings, so have a vested interest in maintaining their value. But they have to balance this with the money they're losing as the U.S. dollar continues to slide. China is another example of such moves. So where to from here? The United States, as it drives its SUV along the crest of peak oil, has different directions it could take, none of them easy, but with very different potential outcomes. One way has light at the end of the tunnel, the other does not. To date, the strategy has been to aggressively protect both the petrodollar and the sources of oil, while simultaneously endeavoring to keep oil and other domestic consumption trends as business as usual, grow the economy, and with it, national debt. It has also joined other nations in a stunning chest-beating display over anticipated fossil fuel spoils from the Arctic. These strategies are a kind of preparation, like hoarding acorns for winter, but one that is wholly short-sighted, ignoring economic, resource, and environmental realities. These are not only poisoned acorns, killing the planet, but they also happen to be the very last ones. This direction keeps the nation wholly dependent on a diminishing resource. People talk about oil production. I actually think my delivery might be here. Bob, you want to roll some music for a minute, please? And we'll come back to this in just a moment.
When I was in service in Rosemary, I won the goodwill of my master and the dame, till a sailor came there one night to land. That was the beginning of my misery. Called for a candle to light him to bed, and likewise a silk handkerchief to tie up his head, to tie up his head as sailors will do. And I said, my pretty Polly, will you come? Now this maid, being young and foolish, she thought it no harm for to lie into bed to keep herself warm. And what was done there I will never disclose, but I wish that short night had been 7 long years. Thank you.
All right, folks. Sorry, false alarm. All right. You know, we're getting kind of on the end of things, and check out Celsius.com, C-E-L-S-A-I-S.com. The article continues to go, and, you know, this reflects back on a lot of what was being spoken about as the ramping up towards the Iraqi conflict was, you know, in full swing. That none of this made sense other than the issue with the pipeline and the issue with oil resources. And Saddam Hussein, as evil as he was using the one thing that he had to get at the United States, which was the petrol dollar. And this is a key reason why, aside from the debt that we have built up by fighting this stupid war to keep, you know, Halliburton and the oil companies rich as hell, this is what this has all been about. And here, now, you have it right here. Iran is already trading in euros and in yen. Obviously, with the oil that they sell to China, they're doing it in the Chinese currency. This sounds like smart business. If you were one of these countries, why would you end up spending all of this extra money to go through all the exchange just to prop up a country that wants to lie and make the world fearful of you? You know, I mean, this is like going, this is just so bringing me way, 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 way back to what brought us into this whole mess. And, you know, all of the saber-rattling nonsense that's going on between the U.S. and Iran, it sounds like something we've heard before, doesn't it? That's because we have heard it before. It's the same bullshit to get people to say, they's evil. Well, you might be able to take the view that they're evil, but it's not for the reasons that they're telling you. And why? Why? You know, we should be trying to get off of the oil standard. But this explains why our government refuses to do so. Our economy has been running on the trade of oil, and it's not even our oil. And we end up propping up a dictatorship like Saudi Arabia with arms and money to keep trying to guarantee the supply of the very thing that's killing us. This is insane. This is absolutely insane. And in the chat room, I think I'm catching here that Gene's going to post this, a link to this on the Head On Radio Network blog. Check it out. This Celsius is one of the best blogs on the web in my mind, hands down. I mean, they're environmentally centric, but they talk a lot about the geopolitical moves that go on with resources. And McIntosh is awesome when it comes to this stuff. He knows what he's talking about. He backs it up. There's tons of links within this text to back up what he's saying. I do believe over at 12th Harmonic Blog, Gail's piece was entitled something like "The Bogus War on Terror and the Real Reserve Currency War." And that's what this whole thing has been about. You know, we get sidetracked with, you know, all these other things that have gone on since, but it's all been about this. It's all, and it goes back to Nixon. removing the gold standard and setting up this situation where the U.S. currency is falsely propped up because all oil has been traded in it. And slowly, as countries see the fact that this just isn't working for them, they're going to continue to move to euros, to the yen, to other things. And no matter what, in some ways, no matter what we do economically in the United States, we're so screwed. Because we sold ourselves down a river of oil. We're absolutely screwed. It's amazing. You know, and hence why you can't get good public transportation in so many places. Because the more cars that are on the road, the more that it keeps propping up the dollar. How do we get out of this? It's gonna hurt. It's gonna hurt. And we have to have a fundamental shift in the way we do things. We need to start basing our currency on something more real and more sustainable. Hence, you know, I covered, you know, this whole area of possible oil reserves, you know, in up north of Canada, in land that isn't claimed by anybody. We could end up having battles there for who gets their hands on those oil reserves. You want to talk about bringing war close to home? We could end up in a war between the United States and Canada for these resources. Absolutely madness. The whole thing is madness. I didn't expect to get so angry today. But, you know, reading stuff like this, you know, after us being in this mess for a few years, you kind of lose track of really how we got here. And the fundamental reason that we went into Iraq is because of Saddam trading oil in euros. It's unbelievable. Check it out, Celsius.com. Check out the Horn blog. It should be up there any moment. Thanks for being with us, folks. Thanks to Billy Shears for the conclusion to the Lennon on Lennon series. Just awesome. Can't wait to see what you've got for us next. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. You, too, can be part of the fight against mountaintop removal mining. Thanks to Scott Barry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you on Monday.
And the sign said, long-haired, freaky people need not apply.